Hi, Lynne Malcolm with you for All in the Mind. Today, children and their emotions. And could it be that kids are more anxious than they used to be?
I think that is quite a controversial issue at the moment because I think we are seeing more presentations of children with anxiety problems, that there are perhaps more children seeking help. But we also are getting better at identifying these problems in young children. We're getting better at knowing what to look for, and teachers are getting better at looking for it. So it is really hard to really know whether there is an actual increase. But there is some convincing evidence that these problems in children and adolescents are on the rise.
Professor Jenny Hudson from the Centre for Emotional Health at Macquarie University. And more about children's anxieties later. Modern psychology, until fairly recently, has focused on how we think and behave rather than how we feel. But now, with an increasing knowledge of neuroscience, understanding children's emotional development can provide essential insights into the person a child becomes.
There is lots of evidence now that, in fact, the emotional system is a highly influential system in the first 6 years of life. So this old part of the brain, the limbic system, which is right in the interior of our brain, is very, very influential in how we develop the cortex or the thinking parts of our brain. And emotional systems do a lot in terms of regulating development in the cortex of the brain. So I think we've reached the point where we actually need to conceive of emotional development as being at the heart and driving a lot of the other developmental domains.
Dr. Rachel Wilson from the University of Sydney, and co-author with her father, Robert Lewis Wilson, of the book Understanding Emotional Development.
We basically have two types of emotions. We have what we call primary emotions, which are the instinctual and innate ones, fear, anger, satisfaction, and some others. And then we have a series of emotions which develop throughout the first few years of life. And these are called the secondary emotions or the social emotions. And they include things like empathy, guilt, shame. Love is one of the first secondary emotions that develops.
Is it likely that children's experience of emotion is different to an adult experience?
Absolutely. We would start by thinking about development in the first year. And in that first year, the babies are, of course, experiencing lots of primary emotions, but they are also developing an attachment or a relationship with their primary caregiver, which is usually the mother, but it can be anyone, the primary attachment figure or caregiver. Now, that relationship is driven by the fact that babies are rather helpless creatures and we have to attend to them. And we have to provide for all their physical needs and their psychological needs as well. And the provision of those needs by the carer actually creates a bond. And it's what we refer to as a reciprocal relationship. And it's not just a one-way relationship where the mother's giving to the child. The child gives back. And the child is made in such a way that the smile and the shape of its face bring pleasure to the adult carer. So this reciprocal relationship is enormously influential in early development and, in fact, lays the path for lots of future development in the child. And we know from studies where we look at that relationship that in children where they have a difficult attachment or their needs are not fully satisfied, that they may go on to experience difficulties later on.
And you often hear about two sorts of attachment. One is a secure attachment, the other is an insecure attachment. What's the difference between those two, and what are the implications about the child's emotional development in that?
Yes, well, we can think about it in terms of the child's dependency needs. And in a secure attachment, the child has had those needs met. They have a nice reciprocal relationship with their carer, and it's characterised by emotional warmth. There are some children who, there are maybe two types of children beyond that. Those whose needs are not met, who are essentially neglected or they're victims of abuse in some shape or form, that leads to attachment problems, obviously. And then there are those whose needs are met only inconsistently. And inconsistent parenting produces its own type of attachment and behavioural issues.
I think one common thing that most parents have probably experienced is at a particular stage, a child gets so anxious when they're separating from you. You know, leave them at a childcare centre and they just go crazy and it's embarrassing in front of all the other parents. Is that an insecure attachment?
Well, look, I've been there and done that, and it's quite a normal behaviour. In fact, in many cases, that kind of separation anxiety is evidence of a secure attachment. We have cases where the quality of the attachment relationship is so poor that the child really doesn't mind leaving their parents at all. And that's the highly neglected cases or the cases where there's abuse. The key of a secure attachment is that when a parent comes back, they are welcomed by the child. They are easily settled by the arrival of that parent or attachment figure. And it's a perfectly normal experience.
Dr. Rachel Wilson. Professor Jenny Hudson is a psychologist at Macquarie University. Anxiety is one of the conditions they often see in their research with children.
I think the most common mental disorder that children experience are the anxiety disorders, and these can be a range of different problems that children might have, like worrying about what other people think of them, worrying about separating from their parents perhaps, or just worrying about a lot of different issues like their schoolwork or getting to school on time or how they're going to do in university even though they might be 7 years of age, those sorts of things. So it's kind of that general worry. But I mean, to some extent, well, everybody experiences anxiety and fear. It's a really normal emotion that everybody experiences, and we wouldn't really call it a problem or a disorder until it really starts to impact on the child's life and stops them from going to school or attending birthday invitations or social events, or stops them from being able to really participate and enjoy life.
Jenny Hudson. Susan Whelan is a children's author and mother of three. She remembers only too well when her daughter, who is now 14, developed debilitating anxiety.
When she was around 7, she started having problems settling at bedtime. She'd never had problems before. She was fine during the day, but she would go to bed and she'd always been quite focused on being good, like doing her best, and it just seemed to ramp up to the point where at bedtime she would lay in bed and run through her day and be thinking about what she could have done better, things that had happened. One of her friends was maybe arguing with another friend and what she could have done so that everyone would have been happy. If she'd forgotten her library books, she'd be running over what she should be doing to make sure that never happened again. And that escalated into her not being able to sleep, and that involved a lot of crying. She would become quite distressed. She wouldn't settle at all unless I was with her. Then she wouldn't settle even if I was with her, because she would be worried that once she went to sleep I would leave, and so she would stop herself from going to sleep so that she could check to make sure that I hadn't left yet. In the end, ironically, she couldn't sleep because she was worried about not sleeping, and she was exhausted. Mm. I checked in with her teachers. The teachers said she was perfectly fine at school, and so she was putting so much effort during the day into being happy and doing everything well that it just all fell apart at bedtime.
And did this fit in with her particular temperament?
I think she's always been a child that really wanted to make the people around her happy. I found out later that she was actually being bullied at school as well by a girl who had previously been a friend, and so that was another factor. But the type of worries that she had were certainly consistent for me with things that had been important for her before.
Susan Whelan, who eventually found some really good help for her daughter's anxiety. Professor Jenny Hudson is from the Centre for Emotional Health at Macquarie University. I asked her what causes children's anxiety.
It's a really complicated question. I think in any child presenting with an anxiety problem, there might be a number of different reasons why that particular child has developed anxiety. But we know there's a fairly moderate genetic component. We know that anxiety runs in families, that if a child has anxiety, the parent's much more likely to have anxiety as well, and vice versa. And that is partly because of genes. We think about 30 to 40% of the variance in anxiety symptoms is because of their genes. But it's also a lot to do with the environment, and that 30 to 40% does leave a huge amount for the environment to impact on the development of anxiety. And there's a lot of different environmental components that might increase a child's chances of developing anxiety. So one of the main things that keeps anxiety going is avoidance. So if you stay away from something that you're scared of, you never really learn that's perhaps not as scary as what you think. And even if it is a bit scary, you can handle it and it's not going to last forever. But if your environment helps to maintain that avoidance or keep you away from situations that might be new or potentially scary, then you never learn really that you can cope with it. So parents who might be more overprotective or kind of rush in to help, which is a really normal response when you have quite an anxious or more sensitive child, often the tendency is to rush in and help them and do things for them just because it's often easier and it reduces the child's distress in the short term. But in the long term, the child never really gets to face new situations and learn that they can cope with it. So we know that is a factor that over the long term increases the child's chances of developing anxiety.
So overprotection, it's actually quite a significant factor.
Yes, it is. So we've been doing a study where we've been tracking children from age 4 through to age 9 and 12. And we've been able to show, particularly at the 9-year-old point, we're still analysing our data actually at the 12-year-old point, but at 9, children whose parents were more overprotective and rushed in more had higher levels of anxiety at age 9, taking into account all the other variables at age 4. So we do know that it's not just an artifact or a correlation, that it does actually increase the child's chances of developing anxiety over time. Some of our research also tells us that it is a normal reaction, that parents of children who have anxiety just are more likely to respond in that way because it's kind of a natural, normal response to want to protect a child who is more sensitive and more anxious.
Is there any evidence that the current situation in our society today, where we're so much more exposed to the media, to horrible stories on the news, and perhaps there's a good reason to be overprotective?
Well, I think that, I mean, children are exposed to a lot more and there's a lot more pressures, and parents, I think, are more concerned about their kids, but perhaps for no good reason. We're actually getting probably quite a biased presentation of what's going on in the world. We forget about all the good things that happen and all the times when a child walks to school and nothing bad happens. So we kind of miss out on that normal information about what's threatening and what's not. And so I think parents might be getting an inaccurate picture of what things to be protective of. And it is, as parents, a natural response, or the normal response is to want to protect your kids as best you can. But I think in the long term, if we're not allowing our kids to face challenging situations and be exposed to new situations, then that does increase their chances of developing anxiety because they don't get normal, realistic information about threat.
What determines whether a child is going to develop mental health issues or not? Say, in one family, just one of the children develops issues and the others don't.
Yeah, often that can be really confusing to parents. We think this has a lot to do with genes and the environment. The certain genes that a child might inherit may interact with environments. So while they might experience similar environments, it's just the presence of specific genetic markers. And it's not just one genetic marker, it's going to be a number, hundreds, potentially thousands of markers that are involved in increasing a child's risk of anxiety, but it's the combination of those genetic markers and the presence of certain environments that increase a child's chances of developing anxiety. Parents might respond differently based on a child's temperament as well. So even though a parent might be saying, oh, well, I treat my children exactly the same way, but in actual fact, they may respond in subtle ways differently depending on the child's temperament and personality. And we know that certain temperaments, like if a child is more inhibited and more wary of new situations, then they are at greater risk of developing anxiety later on. And so parents may respond differently to different styles of temperament.
So what about the individual parental factors, the particular ways that parents behave towards their children or parent their children?
Well, we do know that anxiety runs in families. So if a child is anxious, it's often likely that the parent also has difficulties with anxiety. So you can imagine that combination of a parent who's anxious and a child who's anxious, that can sometimes be really difficult, and that the parent might be more likely to rush in and help, and more likely to model avoidant behaviour, that if a parent is anxious of social situations, they might be more likely to withdraw or not go out as much or not be exposed to those social situations. So a parent's anxiety definitely does impact. And we learn by watching our parents, we learn by watching people in our environment. So that's one of the important ways that we learn. So if we're watching a parent who is more anxious, then we're likely to pick up on those behaviours. And the other way that we learn is just by what we call verbal transmission of threat, by hearing from parents what's scary and what's not. So what things to stay away from and what things to be scared of. And so if a parent's telling you, okay, these presentations and doing talks in front of the class are really stressful and really scary, it's best to stay away from them, or don't touch that spider, or don't go anywhere near that spider, it's going to hurt you, then we're learning information about what's scary and what's not. And so that's another pathway which children can become fearful of certain situations.
You're with All in the Mind on RN, Radio Australia, online and on your ABC Radio mobile app. I'm Lynne Malcolm, and today we're discussing the emotional development and anxieties of children. As part of their research, the Centre for Emotional Health at Macquarie University have been running a treatment program for kids with anxiety. It's called Cool Kids. Professor Jenny Hudson.
It's important to get realistic perspectives out to your children. One of the components that we have in our program is what we call realistic thinking. So it's quite different from positive thinking or trying to think happy thoughts. It's the idea of trying to be more realistic about the way that you're perceiving situations. We know that people who are anxious are more likely to focus on threat in their environment. So at school, they might be focusing on teachers that are saying bad things, negative things, or they may be focusing on the news at certain news events. So a child who is more anxious, and this is the same for adults, they tend to focus more on threat in their environment and attend to it more, kind of vigilant to threat. But we also, in certain situations, might be more likely to interpret an ambiguous situation in a threatening way. So if there's not quite enough information to tell us whether or not it's scary, a child or an adult with anxiety is more likely to kind of choose the scary option or the threatening option. So one of the processes we do through our Cool Kids program is to encourage kids to be more like detectives and scientists with their thoughts. So here's the worried thought that you have, that everyone's going to laugh at me, or I'm going to get in trouble at school. And then trying to collect evidence like a detective would or a scientist would look at the facts for what's really more likely to happen and what's the realistic prediction in this situation. And kids are quite good at developing their facts and getting the information right before they make a judgment about whether or not something they should be scared about. That's one of the strategies we use to help reduce their anxiety. And I think the biggest part of the program that I think that brings about the most change is getting kids to really gradually face situations they've been avoiding. So if they've been avoiding school, we'll break that down into really small steps and get them to gradually approach the situations that they've been scared of, and help parents to do that as well. And parents not to rush in and help and do it for them, but letting the child actually face the situation and learn more information, more accurate information about threat and situation. They're quite common sense strategies. It's not just talking therapy. It's very much a doing therapy and skills based, where the child and the parents learn skills to better manage these emotions.
So what do you know about how effective the program is and whether it's sustainable?
Well, we have really good evidence that the majority of children improve significantly from the beginning of the program through to the end of the program. And we've now done, and there's several clinics around the world that are doing this research and have done really long-term follow-ups, about 5 to 7 years, showing that mostly those effects are maintained. And when treatment is successful as well, there's just some evidence that came out earlier this year showing that those children where the treatment worked, they had less suicidal ideation during early adulthood. So when the program works, we can maintain those effects over time, and it works for the majority of children, which is great. And for younger children and older children, it works, and which is really exciting, because these problems can have such a significant impact on a child's life, not just in childhood, but in adolescence and right through to adulthood, that if we can make a difference in that child's life early, then we can have a long-term impact on their life, which is really exciting.
Jenny Hudson. We heard earlier from Susan Whelan about her daughter Elizabeth's anxiety. Her condition became so upsetting and exhausting that the family sought help from a psychologist.
the focus at the time with the counselling and with the other things was helping her to develop skills so that she could manage her own personality better. I guess she is someone who cares deeply about people around her, and if I'd stepped in to protect her, then that doesn't help her to develop the skills she needs going into adulthood, because that's who she is. She's someone who cares. And so the work of the psychologist and the work that I did at home wasn't to protect her from the things that bothered her. It was to help her develop the skills she needed so that she could think more clearly about the things that bothered her and find ways of working out what was worth worrying about and what she could let go. And I think the fact that now she's a girl who copes so well with the different pressures in her life, partly that's because she did have to deal with the worries. She wasn't protected from them all. She had to learn how to cope with them.
Susan Whelan went on to write a children's book. It's based on her experience of parenting her anxious child.
My picture book's called Don't Think About Purple Elephants, and it was published in April this year. One of the things that we did with Elizabeth was at bedtime, it was trying to help her go to bed not focused on her worries. And we had a few different things we did with that. She had a journal that she wrote in, and it was a way of sort of handing over the things that she was worried about. She knew that they were written down. She'd acknowledge them, but she could then let them go. But another thing we did, because she was only little, we played games at bedtime, silly games and word games that helped her refocus before she went to sleep. And one of the games was one where we had a little memory list of animals that were silly colours, so purple elephants and blue meerkats and green giraffes and things like that. And so the Don't Think About Purple Elephants story is about a little girl who worries at bedtime, and her family all tries to help, and they all come up with all sorts of different things, but nothing really seems to work. A lot of them actually make her worry more. But then the mum says, don't think about purple elephants. And she's so busy trying to not think about purple elephants that all she can think about is purple elephants and the silly things that they're doing. And once she's distracted, she can actually relax and go to sleep. And when she can get a good night's sleep, she can actually think more clearly the next day and not be overreacting to the little things that she was worried about.
Susan Whelan, author of Don't Think About Purple Elephants. So many things happen to families throughout the course of their lives, and you can never completely control or predict how children will be affected. However, Rachel Wilson says that there are some recognised conditions in a child's upbringing which will nurture healthy emotional development.
Well, I think the first thing is that strong relationships which have emotional warmth are very, very protective for children in terms of how they meet developmental challenges, and if they come across difficulties later in life, maybe they fall in with the wrong peer group, maybe they have an accident or become disabled, all those sorts of things. If you have warm relationships and very secure attachment and the opportunity to develop those secondary social emotions well in the early years, you are somewhat protected from the challenges ahead. So that's very important, and I think it's actually a message that we really need to get out there, because lately in child development, there's been a lot of discourse about, you know, the use of praise with children, and perhaps we're not being helpful praising our children. And unfortunately, one of the reactions that parents might feel that they have to take in response to that information is that they become more distant or somewhat colder towards their children, that they don't want to praise them. And of course, we can have lots of warmth with children before we have excessive praise. And that warmth is very, very important to maintain. We really need to ensure that we're providing deep, loving care, looking at all those different needs that an infant has right from the word go, because the first year and the second year are very, very important in development. And the overriding feature is the warmth of a reciprocal relationship in those years. But if you feel, if you've done your own research and you're still concerned, seek expert advice on that. That's what I would do. It's also important to remember that in parenting, any difficulties are often transitory. Because the other principle we have is that early intervention is the most effective.
Dr. Rachel Wilson. Jenny Hudson from Macquarie University has been thinking about her childhood and treasures one event from very early in her life which her parents told her about.
A story actually that's really shaped the way that I have parented my own children as well, in that was when I was, I think, just 1 year old and I was playing out in the backyard and I was just in my nappy and I was starting to play with the hose and getting really muddy and all messy, and my dad went to pull me out of the mud and get me all cleaned up. But Mum said, "Oh no, just stop and let's see what happens. Let's let her play in the mud and it's okay if she gets messy." So they let me play, and it's kind of been a metaphor really for my parenting and our family as well, of just let kids play in the mud and allow them to face situations, even if life is messy and dirty and you get yuck sometimes, that is a good experience to be able to just learn to face those difficult situations and messy situations.
Professor Jenny Hudson from the Centre for Emotional Health at Macquarie University. There's no doubt that parenting can be challenging, and there are so many decisions to be made along the way about how to best care for and manage your child. Dr. Rachel Wilson has also been reflecting on her own upbringing.
For me, you know, really that is a cause for celebration. Clearly my parents had a lot of insight. But when you think about, well, what is it that's made me, you know, take this particular path or another, and how have the difficulties in my life changed my pathways? There's so much room for complexity there. And you think of the millions of possibilities and the, you know, the different points of decision that are taken in a lifespan. I think the evidence is now pretty clear that how we respond to all of those is laid down in the architecture of our brains. And that architecture is developed in the first 2 years of life under the heavy influence of the primary and then the secondary emotions. We know, for example, that children who have a stressful time in those first few years, they produce hormonal response to stress called cortisol, which has a direct impact on neuronal connections. And that feeds into the way our brains are structured and the architecture of them. We also know that we have great plasticity in our brains, and thankfully there's plenty of possibility for remediating some of the difficulties that occur. But remediation of very primary differences in emotional development, children who, for example, have been so abused and neglected that they haven't developed a proper sense of empathy, they haven't developed guilt or shame, those children, regardless, are going to have difficulty in fitting in with broader society. So when we reflect on our own lives, you can't have a memory or any sense of how you were treated and cared for in those very early years. Yet it's highly influential, and you've just got to be lucky sometimes.
Dr. Rachel Wilson, senior lecturer at the University of Sydney and co-author with her father, Robert Lewis Wilson, of the book Understanding Emotional Development. Head to the All in the Mind website for details from today's program, and while you're there, leave a comment, and you might like to connect with us on Facebook too. Thanks to producer Diane Dean and sound engineer Simon Branthwaite. I'm Lynne Malcolm. Thanks for your company. Join us again next week at the same time. Bye for now.
Report podcast, busting the myth that it's bad to talk about suicide.
One of the worst things that we can do is fluff around a subject without actually using the word suicide. So I think if somebody is worried about their son or their daughter, it's absolutely fine to say, often when young people feel like this, they might have thoughts of taking their own lives. Have you had thoughts like that?
That's a confronting Health Report podcast that you can download from RN's website.